Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the IRTP Part D Working Group call on Monday, 25th of March, 2013. On the call today, we have James Bladel, Chris Chaplow, Avery Doria, Christian Durain, Volker Grayman, Barbara Knight, Bob Mountain, Mikey O'Connor, Holly Raish, Bartlett Morgan. We have apologies from Alan Greenberg, Paul Diaz, and Michaela Nealon. And from staff, we have Lars Hoffman, Marika Connings, and myself, Julia Chavolin. May I remind all participants to please state their names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you, Julia, and it's good to see that Marika is on the call, even though she doesn't show up in the Adobe chat. I guess that means she's lurking, watching us from the shadows there. But welcome, everyone, to the IRTPD working call for March 25th. And per our usual order of business, can I ask if anyone has any updates to their statement of interest? Please raise your hand in the Adobe chat room or speak now, please. Hearing none, we'll move on to the adoption of the agenda. These were submitted, the agenda was submitted by Lars earlier to the mailing list and appears in the right-hand column of the Adobe chat room. Any comments, suggestions, or changes to the agenda? Okay, great. So I think we missed last week just because we had multiple conflicts and a number of key individuals were unable to attend. We certainly wanted to, I think, be a little further down the road by the time we were departing for Beijing. However, I think some reality is smacking us in the face a little bit because this group got started so close to that particular meeting. However, I think we can still make some progress here, or as Mikey might say, we can dispense with the appetizers and administrative stuff and get right to the meat and potatoes of some of these issues. And I see he is pulling up his super awesome mind map. So we have started discussing the charter questions for this particular group, and I think we left off with charter question B. And I'm wondering, Mikey, if you can refresh my memory since I missed 2 weeks ago, how far along we got on A or B. Do we need to start at the beginning and review A and B, or can we just dive right in with B, or is that too rough of a segue? What are your thoughts?
This is Mikey. I wouldn't mind taking us through the conversation. I think there were a lot of people who weren't here for it, so let me just take a couple of seconds to replay the bidding from that call, and then we can go on to number C. That way, if there are things on people's mind, we can just tack them on. The first question was question zero, which people were saying maybe we should take a call and do some sort of background session on IRTP and TDRP just to sort of bring us all up to speed. And so we rattled off some ideas about that. And then the two questions that we looked at were A and B, and there what we were puzzling about a bit was, has anything changed since this question was posed back in 1836 when the IRTP discussion began? And so we thought maybe adding something to the stakeholder conversation about that might be a good idea. And then on the second question, the focus of that conversation, the question was whether there additional provisions should be included in the TDRP on how to handle disputes when multiple transfers have occurred. Again, these are old questions, and there's been a lot of conversation and action since then. But one of the themes that came out of that was whether this would be a good one for some data, clearly anonymized, scrubbed kind of data, but data nonetheless. That was sort of it for the first two. So if this surprises anyone or if there's anything that they'd like to add, this would be a good time. And then otherwise, I'll hand it back to James, and we can jump into the third question.
Thanks, Mikey. I don't any thoughts. I don't see any hands in the queue. You know, I have some basic fundamental questions regarding really this item B. It probably ties back into A. Is really how common is this? You know, I don't know if that's part of what we can say about getting data.
Yeah, that was really the theme.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, we don't need a new line then.
Yeah, and so I'll just add that in, you know.
Okay. And I think that Bob Mountain, I believe, not to put you on the spot, Bob, but I think you raised that question as well, if memory serves.
Yeah, I believe that's correct, yeah.
At least I'm hearing that question in your voice, so...
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's, I do think that's important to, I'm sorry, this is Bob. I do think it's important for us to ask the question up front is to what extent it's a problem and to what extent we can quantify it. I think that's a great, you know, foundation point for our, for the exercise going forward. And I'm happy to volunteer to be involved in structuring that if we decide to do a questionnaire or something like that.
Okay, definitely we'll pick. Probably take you up on that and appreciate the offer. And really, what I'm thinking here, I see Marie has her hand up. We'll go to her in just a minute. But really, what I'm thinking here is that I think we determined in IRTP-B that TDRP was just really not used to handle any urgent or emergency hijacking type scenarios. So would this really apply? Because what it seems like it's describing here is a hallmark of those types of hijacking. So I wonder if this is, if we're crossing our wires here a little bit. But anyway, I'll go to Marika first and then Barbara. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. Sorry for joining a bit late. But just to share with you, when I was researching this question for the issue report, you know, diving into the IRTP archives from many, many years ago, I actually had great difficulty in finding any additional information apart from the actual question on how, you know, how to handle disputes when multiple transfers have occurred. I wasn't even able to find what was actually meant with that question, and we've assumed, or when writing the issue report, I assumed that it indeed meant, you know, transferring one domain name registrations several times. But I guess you could even interpret it in different ways, you know, could you have disputes at the same time for one registrant for different domain names, for example. So, again, I think it's a really good point to try to find out some more information on this, as, you know, I wasn't able to do so as part of, I think, the initial discussion that actually put this question into the mix of things.
Now, that's interesting. Thank you, Marika, because I think we just assumed we were reading it in one direction, but it could be... it could be interpreted to be somewhat ambiguous. Barbara.
Thank you, James. This is Barbara. I mean, I can speak from our perspective and the experience that we've had here at VeriSign, and it's not often that we see these anymore. It seems like a while ago there was a situation where we were seeing a lot of transfers of three-letter domain names, and in that particular case, we were seeing what we call domain hopping or you know, from one registrar to another. So there was a fraudulent transfer, and then there may have been, you know, subsequent legitimate transfers that occurred after that as it relates to the same domain name. We kind of coined the phrase, you know, we kind of call it domain laundering because it's almost as though, you know, people are hijacking the name, but then, you know, they're trying to cleanse it by passing it through a bunch of other registrars legitimately. So, we haven't seen it a lot. Obviously, I don't have numbers off the top of my head as far as, you know, how often we've seen it. But and there's so few that actually make it to the registry operators for review as a request for enforcement anyway, that, you know, the number that we have is pretty limited. But we've not seen this in quite a while.
Okay, thanks, Barbara. And domain laundering is what we've called it as well, because I think that's definitely what they're trying to do, just like cash, they're trying to disguise its origins. And I think that that is an important point, going back to one of the things that I mentioned originally. Maybe in this particular type of hijacking scenario, the laundering would complicate or confound the registrar's attempts to work together to resolve the transfer. Maybe the only appropriate mechanism to deal with that would be the registry, since, you know, while it may hop 20 different registrars, it's always going to be the same registry, obviously. So that's good good information there. Chris, you're up next.
Yeah, thanks. There's a couple of examples I've seen recently where a domain was, well, one where a domain that had been awarded to somebody in Sunrise was hijacked and appeared in the aftermarket, appeared on Sedo for sale. I recognised what it was, that it had been a hijack, and contacted various people, and it was the sale was blocked until it was sorted out. But it did occur to me what would have happened if the domain had been bought and this had transferred again. And another case I've got at the moment, I won't repeat it, but it's the same sort of thing where it has been transferred to a third party. And that does make it very complicated. I don't know what the solution is, but it does occur to me that when this was written, the aftermarket wasn't as mature as it is now. And I think it's now the scenario is probably more common or plausible or easy for it to happen, that it can be hijacked and then sold on very much more quickly perhaps than it would have been before. So maybe we're looking at a scenario where we've got mechanisms in place that didn't exist when this was written. Thanks.
Thanks, Chris. And I think I agree with you that a lot of these things did not exist, or let's say a lot of these things predate the growth of the aftermarket or the secondary market. Volker, how are you, sir?
Thank you, James. Very good. I hope you're well as well. What I was thinking is that we took care of a lot of this in the IRTPC already by not only requiring the 30-day wait period after a transfer, but also implementing it for an owner change as well. And due to the times involved in transferring a domain name from registrar to registrar and then again, I think the problem has been already very much reduced. I certainly have never seen a case where we heard about that.
Okay, thank you, Volker. I know that we may have addressed some of these with some of the proposed changes from IRTPC. I think that we may consider, and this gets back to my original question, is how is TDRP being used today? Do we have sufficiently viable alternatives, or are there some cases, like in the case of laundering, where only the TDRP can fix the problem? And if so, how frequent is that, or how prevalent of an issue is that, or is this a, you know, as Bob was pointing out, is this a black swan type of a scenario where it's just, you know, 1 in 100,000 or something type of event, but you have to have a special mechanism because when it occurs, nothing else can fix it, or something like that. You know, I'm just putting these things out here as just ideas of what we need to understand is the scope of the TDRP and its utility in the current environment. Barbara is up next.
Thank you, James. This is Barbara. So, I mean, I think it is reduced, but I think that given that the statute of limitations for filing a dispute is 6 months, there is potential that it could happen again, that we even with the provisions that we put in place for IRTPC. So I can speak from our implementation, and I know our supplemental rules, we specifically indicate that if it looks as though we have a place for not only for the registrar who is filing the request for enforcement to, obviously, they're completing it. They would be the filing registrar, and then there's a respondent registrar. That's the registrar to whom the domain name was allegedly fraudulently transferred, and then who the current registrar of record is. So from our perspective, you know, we're obviously going to be looking at whether or not the transfer from registrar A to registrar B was fraudulent, but to the extent that a different registrar is currently managing it, regardless of, you know, if there were like even a couple of other hops in between before it finally ended up in its current resting place at the point in time that the domain was, added to a request for enforcement and filed with us. You know, one of the first things that we'll do is once we get the request for enforcement is we'll go ahead and lock the domain name so it cannot be transferred further. But then we also would then notify the current registrar that we have received a request for enforcement relating to a domain name that is under their management. So in that, we do reserve the right that if we discover that the domain name was fraudulently transferred from the first registrar to the second registrar, you know, we basically put them on notice that we could be pulling that domain name back and giving it to the filing registrar. So that kind of gives you an idea of how, you know, we at VeriSign had implemented, you know, the TDRP portion of that relating to the situations where there are multiple transfers before, you know, in that statute of limitations within which the request for enforcement can be filed. So I don't know if that's helpful at all or not.
I think so, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, Barbara, but I think, speaking for myself, I think it would be really helpful if in our discussions of question B, if we could have some sort of a process diagram of your current practices and how that looks. Is that something you would be willing to take on?
I can definitely look at that, yeah.
Okay, because I think that there's I don't trust, you know, reading the transcripts and understanding that what you just said, I think, was very both important and also a lot to digest just verbally. So if we had something like that, I think it would be helpful.
Okay, yeah, I'll try to put a kind of summary of that together for the working group.
Okay, and then the second question would be, so you're saying there's situations where I'm a registrar, I'm the caboose, I'm at the end of the line of all these transfers, and you would come up to me and say, hey, registrar James, I have to take this name back because although the transfer inbound to you was legitimate and you know, obtained the FOA and got all the necessary authorizations, three transfers ago, this name was hijacked, and therefore everything after that or everything downstream from that incident, you know, is invalidated. And I think that would be an interesting scenario, and I would be really interested to see how that plays out in the real world and whether or not registrars say, okay, I understand, you know, I certainly wouldn't want any pushback or any guff if that happened among my customers, or if registrars say, no, I did everything I was supposed to do, why should I, you know, why should VeriSign have the ability to do this? And it would be just more of an interesting case study, I think, from my understanding.
Right.
Chris.
This is Barbara. Is it okay if I just kind of jump in there again?
Yeah, sure, please.
I mean, obviously, it has been a while since we've seen one of these types of cases, but you know, my recollection is that, you know, because we do publish our supplemental rules out there, and the supplemental rules are within the registry operator's purview to basically say this is how we're going to administer the transfer dispute resolution policy part of the IRTP. You know, it's almost as though if you have a com or a net or a name, domain name, and you're bound by the IRTP, then, you know, indirectly you're also bound by the registry's implementation of the TDRP process as the first level dispute resolution provider. So I don't recall if we've actually had to pull one back from a third registrar. I can look into that and see. But believe it or not, I don't recall, like I said, it's been quite a while, I don't recall actually getting a lot of feedback from any registrars that we've had to provide. And granted, we don't provide them any detail on what the specifics are relative to the dispute that's been filed. We just let them know that the domain name, one of the domain names, and you provide the domain name that's under their management is subject to a dispute. So, you know, from that perspective, I don't recall seeing a whole lot of feedback, and I can double-check to see how many times we've actually had to pull a name back from a third registrar that actually happened to be managed the name, a domain name that was found to be fraudulently transferred.
Okay, thanks. And just one other thought, and it occurred to me while you were mentioning this, that I think we need to make sure, because I know that you're representing a number of registries on this, and Roy and Paul are not on the call, but anything that we would discuss, we should probably keep in mind that there's probably the VeriSign, you know, I think, like, for example, the RFE that you mentioned is a VeriSign-specific provision. as opposed to a GTLD-specific provision. Is that correct?
Actually, an RFE, a request for enforcement, is under the TDRP, the Transfer Dispute Resolution Policy. That is a standard term. So, so that exists for all registered accounts.
Some of the things you were discussing, I think, might be centric only to Verisign, correct?
The supplemental rules. Registry operator can put in place their own supplemental rules. So it may be worth our while to take a look at, and I can have some conversations with Roy and also Paul and some of the other registry operators to see, kind of where they are. And I don't know if they're willing to share them. I know we hold ours pretty tightly. We obviously have them available for registrars, but I can see what information I can get relative to other registry operators' implementation and of their transfer dispute process. So let me see if I can find out, because you're right. I mean, how we do it could be very different from how any of the other registries do it.
Okay, thanks, Barbara.
Sure.
Hello, Chris. You're up next.
Hi there. Thank you. Yeah. Following the same trail of this and the scenario where there's a hijack from Registrar A to Registrar B, and then a registrant has then purchased the domain in good faith and it's moved to Registrar C, I would be interested. It's sort of like an extra dimension from the registrant's point of view of then it's discovered and it's all too late. What are the implications? And it's almost a legal opinion, and I'm not a lawyer, so I can only sort of think about it, but we could almost do with adding in a legal opinion on it, and what would the registrant do, and how would they ever begin to start to recover the monies that they spent on this domain, which then could be taken away from them? Where would the recourse be? So it's just an extra dimension to that, the last point we've been following. Thanks.
It is, and I agree that it is an important point, Chris. Don't know that it's I'm not sure that it would fall into ICANN's lap to address some of those things, because it sounds like that would be something that would go to court. I think it's Christian pointed something out there. It's that this is true in the general case. I put myself in the queue really more as a bookmark here to remind us that we need to move on to some of the other questions. But I'll go to Volker next, and then we'll wrap up on this particular charter question B. Volker?
Actually, I just wanted to cut into the same groove that Chris just mentioned, as it will be very difficult for a registrar or even a registry to determine if the secondary transfer was a transfer in good faith or another attempt at domain laundering. And I certainly would hate to be faced with a situation where I, as registrar, would be forced under the policy to return a domain name to someone who has lost it over a year ago and then face damage claims from my customer or the registrant at the time that we transferred back, because he would be entitled to that, because he was at that point already under German law or any other law the legitimate owner of the domain name, having purchased it in good faith.
Okay, thank you, Volker. Yes, I think that that is part of what Chris was discussing, and I think it is a very real and important consideration. I think it is also worth wondering what, what we're worth discussing, what ICANN's role would be in that scenario, if any. So if we could move to question C. So that's a good conversation, everyone, and thank you to Mikey for, I believe, very judiciously capturing all that stuff while our conversation was roaming on those various topics. So thanks, Mikey, for capturing all that and organizing it on the fly. But if we can move on to item C, whether dispute options for registrants should be developed and implemented as part of the policy. And I think that the question here is really talking about not creating a new mechanism necessarily, but my understanding is that this is giving registrants access to the TDRP mechanism directly, as opposed to requiring them to work through a registrar, because I believe that you could also then make the case that if a registrant raises a concern and says, hey, registrar, I'd like to initiate a TDRP and dispute this particular transfer, that the registrar then has the ability to say, yep, this looks fishy, I'm with you, I'm going to go ahead and launch this this procedure. But the registrar could also conceivably say, no, this looks legitimate, or no, you know, this is not something we do, or not a service we offer, or not something we normally get involved in. So it is possible that the fact that there is this middle layer involved, you know, that it could be a decision point and not just a relay. On the other hand, we really don't have many functions, I think, in the GTLD space that allow registrants to interact directly with registries. So let's put this up for discussion. I see we have Christine. Is it Christine? Am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yes, thank you. It's Christine Doreen, and I'm with National Arbitration Forum, and we are one of the TDRP providers that is not a registry. And I wanted to just throw out there just for statistics or data that we get probably 3 to 5 inquiries a month from people who say their domain name's been stolen or hijacked in some way, and that they want to try to get it back through the UDRP and or the TDRP. A lot of the registrars will tell their clients who say, oh, my domain name was stolen, they'll say, oh, well, you have to use the UDRP to get it back. And then they call us up and we say, well, you know, do you have a trademark? And they say, well, no, it was just a domain name. And we tell them, you know, you're probably going to lose a UDRP in that case if you don't have a trademark. And they say, what options do I have? And I said, well, you need to get your losing registrar to do a TDRP for you. And they'll say, well, we tried and they won't do it. So I would say, you know, 3 to 5 on average a month of registrants who have lost a domain name and have no recourse to get it back because the registrar will not, you know, on their behalf, institute the dispute policy with us. I don't know, you know, how many times they will go to VeriSign or whoever else, but I just want to throw that out there as sort of a statistic.
Okay, Christine, thank you, and that is interesting. My question as a follow-up would be, do we know why the registrars would say no to a registrant requesting TDRP? Is it because they're not aware? Because they're recommending the wrong thing, UDRP? Is it because they, you know, they don't think it's part of their business to do this, or?
Well, I think part of it is, I think it's a couple different reasons from what I've understood, is that they don't understand it and they don't really know what the process is about, or they don't want to go through it, or the hassle of gathering the data and everything that they need to do to make it happen. But I think part of it might be the cost. You know, we charge about $1,100 for the TDRP disputes, whether it's an appeal or a request for enforcement. So it could be, and it is a loser-pays system, but they may not want to pay. I've suggested to registrants that they offer to pay the fee themselves, but maybe the cost is too much. I don't know.
Interesting. And then I think that raises the question of should they be starting with the provider at all, or should they be, you know, I think in the current state of things, they start with the registrar, but even then, it seems like the next logical step would be the registry as opposed to the provider. But, Kevin, why don't we go to you? And
this is Kevin Erdman. I wanted to comment. That was very helpful information from Christine. I think the basic difficulty for the registrants is that most of the contractual relationships that a registrant has with its providers do not cover that scenario, so that the registrant who loses domain name doesn't have there's not a contractual responsibility between the service provider and that registrant that had its domain hijacked. And so they can either say, well, gee, we're going to sue you because you lost our name, and see how far that gets them, but that's really, you know, counterproductive to what they really need, which is, you know, to have some mechanism for the cooperation of the registrant and the various service providers to try to remedy their situation. And it may be that there are a lot of folks out there that have the legal capabilities of hopping on it and doing what the registrant would want, but there's probably a lot that don't. And it makes sense to me to make the IRTP a little more flexible by providing another avenue for a registrant to try to jumpstart the process. Because it's counterproductive if the only thing they can do is say, well, if you service provider aren't going to help me on this, then I'm going to have to sue you, and that certainly doesn't start the process right on a good measure. So that's my two cents.
Thanks, Kevin. And I'm thinking through a little bit of what you're saying. So you're saying it's possible that there could be a scenario where the registrant is both suing their registrar or service provider, but also relying on them, depending on them to be kind of act in their behalf on this in this process.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the way the IRTP is set up. It's between the registrant doesn't have a direct participation, so the only way that a registrant can do that is ultimately tell the service providers, well, you're in breach of your obligations to safekeep my domain name, and therefore, my only remedy, if you won't cooperate, is to sue you. And, that's just maybe the better solution is to require all domain service contracts to have that sort of chain of command where the registrant has the ability to compel the other party, but that doesn't seem to be quite as feasible as just letting the registrant be able to enter into the transaction itself.
Okay, thank you. And so seems like where we're headed with this is this idea that a registrant could file their own TDRP, sort of a parallel of UDRP. Am I paraphrasing that correctly?
Well, yeah, I think that we have to give a mechanism for the registrant to participate. I think there is a potential danger of creating a dispute between a registrant and this wherever the hijacker is, and not involving the actual service providing chain that was involved in the process, and ICANN has the ability to link those all together. So I think one solution could be we just say the registrant can start the process, and then we need to figure out by the registrant starting the process what do we need to compel the other organizations to do to facilitate that resolution.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. Barbara, you're up.
Thank you, James. This is Barbara. So, while I don't think that it's a bad idea to allow registrants to be able to initiate transfer disputes, the concern that I would have would be to authenticate the registrant, because I know we're kind of an anomaly. We're a thin registry, so we don't have any registrant data in our databases, nor do the second-level transfer dispute resolution providers have information relative to who a registrant is. So, one, try to figure out, is it a legitimate registrant? I almost think that, to the extent that a registrant can go to either a registry operator as the first-level dispute resolution provider or a dispute resolution provider at the second level, I think that there would have to be engagement back to the registrar of record in order to be able to actually initiate it. And, since this is a consensus policy, registrars are technically required to comply with it. So if a registrar is not opening up a dispute on behalf of their registrant, then, they obviously aren't providing the level of services they're supposed to be under the policy. So, I think that, it may be, fine for the registrants to be able to come directly to the dispute resolution providers. I think that, at the end of the day, we do have to loop back with the registrars as well. and really find a way to encourage them to provide and, you know, provide the service and open up a request for enforcement with either the first or the second level dispute resolution providers at that point.
Thanks, Barbara. So that's interesting. And one of the things I was kind of taking in listening to your description, as well as some of the things we were hearing from Christine and Kevin, was that if we were to allow registrars to file this directly, similar to a UDRP outside of the registrar, then, you know, I think that that is certainly one avenue to go, but we should be aware that doing so would probably mean a, and I haven't looked at the TDRP process, but we would probably have to re-engineer that whole thing, because now it has a new start point and a new owner of that process, as opposed to the way it's currently written, which is you know, which is registrars initiating with registries. And so there's the potential that we would have to start with not quite a blank page, but the TDRP would be significantly modified. Whereas, you know, I think that Barbara raises a different approach, which is if we were to compel registrars to, you know, relay those requests, you know, or remind them if they already are compelled, that might be a simpler approach without requiring a rewrite of that process. But I think that raises the question, and I think Mikey has it as one of the ones he's captured there on the mind map, which is, why are they refusing? If it's because they don't know, or because they think they can, or if it's a lot of work or whatever, well, that's one thing. But if they have a legitimate, if registrars have a legitimate reason that they don't want to entertain every TDRP request that comes through them, or if they have a process for evaluating the legitimacy of those requests, then I think that that's something that that we need to discuss and we need to take a look at, because I think while some segments might reflexively assume that registrars are going to always take the path of least resistance, I think, you know, it may be the case that they have a legitimate concern here. So so I think those are the questions on the table for these this particular question, B and C. Okay. Marika is in the queue. Go ahead, Marika.
Yeah, this is Marika. One additional question we raised in the issue report for the, in relation to this specific charter question is whether the working group should also consider you know, how or if or whether the TDRP should be modified to accommodate disputes that may occur under the new policy for change of registrant. It's something I think we actually didn't really consider as part of the IRTP Part C discussions. But I think it's a very valid consideration that, you know, will either emerge as part of the implementation-related discussions or maybe something that can already be addressed as part of these discussions. Because, indeed, if there is going to be a modification or a rewrite of the TDRP, you know, we may also want to consider, you know, some of the new elements that are going to be introduced and how they would factor in here, as, you know, there may be situations, indeed, where there can be conflicts with regards to, you know, change of ownership or registrant changes. So that may be another element that would need to be factored in into this discussion.
Thank you, Marika. I agree. And I think I see Mikey trying to tuck that in here under under one of these questions. But I'm looking through this, and one of the thoughts I'm having, and I put this out to the group for discussion, is that that issue that Marika raises might be overarching enough to warrant its own issues for or a charter question, because we've made so many changes to the transfer process since, you know, as a result of IRTPB and IRTPC, does that change the nature of TDRP? Does the TDRP now affect things like change of registrant, but could it affect other things like, well, probably not TAC, but other types of things could be open for dispute now because they are now part of this revised transfer process? I don't know the answer, and I think that, you know, could be something worth discussing as an undercurrent to all of these charter questions, or at least most of them. So thank you, Marika. The queue is clear. Did anybody else want to weigh in on this question, charter question C? Okay. So let's see if we – Marika. Sorry, jumped the gun.
Sorry, this isn't working. I was just too late putting up my hand. But just pulling up the TDRP, you know, following your comment, because basically – but it does say that the TDRP and corresponding procedures will apply to all domain names for which transfer requests are submitted on or after the effective date of this policy. In that sense, you know, in the preamble, it does talk about the IRTP, but here, for example, it doesn't specify whether that's transfers between registrars or registrants. So, again, maybe the way it's currently written, it could already accommodate as well the other parts of the policy. And as I said, maybe it's something that will, or that's probably something that will come up as well as part of the implementation consideration, but maybe it's something that the working group may want to have a look at or factor in, and, you know, if any changes are going to be made or recommended, you know, maybe helpful to do that all together, factoring indeed, as you said, some of the other changes that have been made recently, and making sure that that's covered, and, you know, we don't come up with something that addresses maybe one point, but then we need to have another PDP to address other elements that would need to be considered or factored in.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's a good point, especially I think TDRP seems to anticipate one of the recommendations of IRTPC, which was to start making distinctions between transfers between registrars and transfers between registrants, and of course the scenario where both are changing at the same time. Okay, so can we then take a look at item D? We have a few minutes here. I wanted to save the last 10 minutes for discussion of the slides for Beijing. But if we could take a look real quickly here at item D, and if we start to get a queue here, then maybe we'll postpone this one until our next meeting. But whether requirements or best practices should be put into place for registrars to make information on transfer dispute resolution options available to registrants. I don't get this last part. Penalties for IRTP violations. I'm not really sure what that means. But I think what this is saying is
sorry to butt in on you, James, but that was something I transcribed in from the charter. I couldn't figure out a graceful way to do it, but that confused me as well. So I stuck it in here just to force that confusion and ask Marika what that meant. That penalties for IRTP violations was sort of a standalone part of the charter, right below that charter question. And I didn't know if it went with that charter question, if it was a separate question. What was meant by that? So I just crammed it in. Back to you, James. Sorry.
Oh, no. Looks like Lars has his hand up, actually. Maybe he wants to answer. Lars?
Yeah, I'll give it a go. It's actually, I believe, the headline, if you want, for question E, the same way that need for FOAs is the headline for question F. I just put a space in between them now to kind of make that a little bit more clear.
Thanks, Lars. I'll fix that as we go.
Thanks, Lars, and thanks, Mikey, for fixing that. I mean, what I'm hearing here with this particular question is disclosure. So how does a registrant know what mechanisms are available to them, particularly if the registrar has implemented registry-specific procedures for raising TDRPs? So I think this is something that that we could take a look at as far as what our registrar is currently doing and what's you know, I think more information is always better, but as we've discovered in previous PDPs, and Alan is not currently on the call this week, he sent his apologies, but he was involved in a PDP where we were wrestling with certain disclosure type things and reminder emails, and I think that the challenge, of course, is to put something front and center so that registrants can read and understand and have access to the information that they need without overloading them with 68-page documents full of technical language that starts to look like, you know, like the terms and conditions that start to give everyone headaches, and they just click through without looking at it, or what we call, you know, the iTunes agreement syndrome, where everybody just clicks it so they can get the latest update. So we're trying to obviously split the difference between those two extremes. But I don't see a cue on this one yet, and we only have a minute left. So my recommendation is this is where we pick up next time, is charter question D, and that will give us a few minutes here to review the slides. So thank you, everyone who contributed, and thank you, Mikey, for mapping our minds. Okay, Lars, I'm wondering if you could put these slides up in the Adobe room, if you have the ability to share those while I introduce them. And folks, for those who are new, every PDP working group that is currently underway provides an update to the GNSO Council at ICANN meetings, and this is something that Marika has done for us, I think, very, very astutely for a number of years. And this is another one of those cases. However, I think the torch is being passed to Lars, so I imagine Lars would be riding shotgun on this particular update. But I don't think there's anything controversial here. I have reviewed these with Mikey and Lars and Marika. Mikey, I didn't know if you had any. I didn't see anything from you, so I assume you're okay with the edits that I submitted.
Yep, I'm fine.
Okay, so let's run through them real quickly here. Nice graphic on slide one. Slide two provides a few bullet points on background. I think we all have individual scroll control here.
Yep.
Okay. Talks about the consensus policy. Then it talks about the series that we're in. And I hope the counselors don't ask my opinion about that, because they'll get an earful. But we live in the world that we have, right? And then there's a sentence here, a little bit about the charter and how we came about some of the additional issues, not only for this working group, but there was supposed to be also, I believe, an IRTPE, which was folded into this working group, as well as one extra issue that was identified and slotted in here by the IRTPC working group. So That's kind of a mouthful, but that's what that bullet point is getting at. And then finally, just the background of what the council last did as their involvement. Next slide discusses just an overview of the charter questions without diving into each one individually or explicitly. Anyone see anything? I mean, those are a summary, so you may not see them word for word reflected in our charter. And the next slide, just a summary or an overview of membership, and this being a registrar or an inter-registrar policy. I think we see that it is registrar heavy in terms of membership, but that's mainly because it's an operational type of a working group. Next slide talks about our accomplishments to date. We formed a working group in late February. We worked on a work plan and adopted that. We finalized our input requests, where those were sent out a week ago, and that we are currently assessing our charter questions. You may want to add in there that I feel like there was one other thing that we did as far as an accomplishment, but it must not have been important. The next slide looks at some of the tentative deadlines that we've established for ourselves. I think we could probably maybe add one or two more, but these are just driven directly from those orange highlighted areas in our work plan. So that's it for the slide update. I'm thinking it's less information in slides and bullet points and more just a skeleton that will prompt further questions from council and initiate a conversation or engage with individual council members that have any questions. And our council rep, I believe, our council liaison is Volker. Is that correct?
Yep, that's correct.
Okay, so hopefully, you know, you now had a preview of this from both sides, from the working group side and from the council side, so it won't be a surprise. And if there are any questions or if they want to request any further information or clarification on this, that we'll come prepared to Beijing with that. Okay. I just ran through those kind of quick and dirty. If anybody has any edits, maybe we can set a deadline by, I don't know, Lars, what do you think? If we said close of business end of day tomorrow for any final edits, otherwise we'll just consider this adopted. Does that sound reasonable, Lars?
That's fine by me, yes, absolutely.
Okay, so hopefully that sounds that everything. I see some green checks. So, yeah, I don't think there's anything either earth-shattering or controversial in here. And, of course, anyone who is in Beijing during the council update, I don't know if we have a slot on the GNSO agenda yet. Probably it would be Saturday. But we'll post that to the list when we have it. And, of course, any member of the working group that wants to attend this session, sit in there, raise your hand, let the counselors know what you think, let us know how much you love us or hate us or whatever. you know, we'll make sure that opportunity is available for everyone. Okay. We have Lars in the queue, and then we have one announcement about next week's meeting, so go ahead, Lars.
Just very quickly, the meeting with the council is confirmed at the moment for Saturday at 14:30 to 1500 hours in Beijing time. It's also on the right under point 3 in the agenda on the Adobe Connect.
Ah, thank you. So if I had read our own agenda, I would have known that. So I apologize for that. So it looks like 14:30 local time on Saturday in Beijing. I don't know how many folks. Maybe we can real quickly, how many folks using green check marks plan to be at the Beijing meeting?
This is Angie, and I'm not on Adobe Connect, so I'll just chime in that I'm unfortunately not going to be able to attend.
Okay. I see a pretty solid group. Rob's going to be remote. Okay. Volker, I think you'll have to be there, so.
Yeah, no way around that.
Barbara, any plans?
No, any participation I'll be doing will be done remotely.
Okay, Barbara will be remote, and Kevin, remote as well? Yeah, maybe Kevin's off the audio. Christine, looks like remote as well.
Remote possible.
Okay, so we've got, you know, we'll have maybe half a dozen folks there, so that's good. And so that'll be good. And, you know, if you get in, I know a lot of folks tend to arrive on Sunday, which means they'll be in flight on Saturday while we're giving this update. But if you're in town and you're not too sleepy, feel free to stop by and join us in our update. The final thing, and then we'll give everyone their time back, is that due to the Easter holiday, particularly those countries, I think primarily in Europe, and some other areas that extend the Easter holiday through through Monday, we will be canceling our next call on April 1st. So that is that means that this is essentially the last time we'll see each other until we're on the other side of the world, or at least for me, on the other side of the world. So, you know, I guess that's if you have any, I guess the action items here would be, there were a couple, I think, for Barbara, and then there was one for anyone who had any last-minute items for the PowerPoint slides, and otherwise we would just kind of reconvene this group in China. And Avery, no, I wish it were, but it is, we're hearing a lot of folks saying that it's going to be a very sparsely attended group, especially the European members. So, any other? Oh, the joke was a joke. Okay, so it was very meta. You went kind of over my head with that one. Sorry. Any other thoughts or updates, folks, before we adjourn?
if you want.
Okay, thanks. Yes, Mikey, we are too earnest and sincere. We fall for that stuff every time.
Oh, wow.
Okay, everyone. So have a great holiday for those of you that are having holidays. And for those of you who are traveling, stay safe. And hopefully everyone's visas are in order. And as we discussed at the top of the call, if you have respiratory issues or allergies, you know, you might want to look into some of those dust masks, because the news reports coming out of Beijing are not good. But otherwise, it should be a fun meeting, and I don't mean to sour it for those. I'm actually trying to make the folks who are not coming feel better. So have a great week, and we'll see you in China.
Thanks, James. Thanks, Mikey.
Thank you. Bye-bye.